You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Fancy Bear has its very own rootkit. VPN filter turns out to do a lot more than previously suspected. One of the Salisbury assassins is identified as a GRU kernel. A voice recorder app is kicked out of Google Play for being a banking Trojan. Apple's device enrollment program may have authentication issues. Big tech might learn to like being regulated. And farewell to one of Bletchley Park's Jenny Wrens. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, September 27th, 2018. There are a few Fancy Bear sightings to report today. You'll recall that Fancy Bear is what Russia's GRU has come to be called when it operates in cyberspace. Or, if you insist, Mr. Putin, Russia's GU, since, ho-ho, there's strictly speaking no such thing as the GRU because its name got changed, and anyway, it doesn't exist. We say phooey. Whatever the acronym, it's the same old firm, and we doubt the misdirection works even at the UN. So tell it to Turtle Bay, or save it for a meteor shower over Chelyabinsk. But no one here is buying. Security firm ESET, the gang from Bratislava, reported yesterday that Fancy Bear is deploying a rootkit against its foreign targets. They're active so far mostly in the Balkans and other Central and Eastern European countries. And the kit they've deployed is LoJax, malware developed from the LoJax anti-theft software. The attribution to Fancy Bear is, as is usually the case, circumstantial but compelling, based on the presence of other known Fancy Bear hacking tools. Cisco's Talos unit looked into VPN filter malware and has discovered that it's even more capable than initially believed. The researchers found 7 additional modules in VPN filter. They think it was designed to debut against Ukrainian targets on the anniversary of the NotPetya attacks, but they also note that VPN filter was also designed to be a long-term attack platform. The malware is particularly adapted for IoT attacks, especially against vulnerable routers. When Talos started checking on VPN filter this spring, it was hitting home routers, mostly those manufactured by MikroTik. At the time, the U.S. FBI attributed the campaign to Fancy Bear, took control of some of its command and control infrastructure, and advised everyone to reboot their routers. It's difficult to say how many devices remain vulnerable, but VPN filter turns out to be more capable than hitherto believed. The 7 new modules include an HTTP traffic redirection and inspection tool, an SSH utility, some network mapping functionality, a denial of service tool, a network traffic forwarding unit, a SOX5 proxy, and a reverse TCP VPN. So it does a lot. And one of the suspects in the Salisbury nerve agent attacks has been identified as a GRU kernel. Both of the men British authorities hold responsible for the nerve agent attack in Salisbury have so far been known by their pseudonyms, Ruslan Bosharov and Alexander Petrov. Bosharov turns out to be one GRU colonel, Anatoly Chepiga, an officer thrice deployed to Chechnya during 17 years' service as a Spetsnaz goon. He was also awarded the Order Hero of the Russian Federation in 2014 by decree from the Russian president for peacekeeping, which probably means hybrid warfare against Ukraine. The investigative site Bellingcat, which did much of the inquisitorial heavy lifting here, says that Chepiga's alma mater, the Far Eastern Military Command School, has his name and the award up on their wall of honor. His mention is to the right of their statue of Marshal Rokossovsky. It's worth noting that the honorific Hero of the Russian Federation is by custom awarded personally by the Russian president, the way the U.S. Medal of Honor is normally presented by the U.S. president. This would seem to deprive President Putin of some deniability he's hitherto claimed. Fact is, he probably pinned the medal on Chepiga personally. Chepiga's fellow tourist, Alexander Petrov, has yet to be identified. We live in a world with Twitter bots, fake and stolen Facebook profiles, and even automated AI-driven customer service chatbots. As the technology matures, it's getting hard to be sure you're dealing with a real human being. This notion of synthetic identities is cause for concern and attention. Daniel Riedel is CEO of data security firm New Context, and he offers these thoughts.
I think with synthetic identities, it depends on the industry that you're in to a certain extent. I think the banking industry has their concept of what synthetic identities are. I think other industries do as well. Obviously, with the banking industry, it has to do with, you know, sort of fraudulent uses of payment systems. But I think that synthetic identities is going to grow and morph in ways that in some cases we can't foresee. It's sort of the unknown concept, but I think it's going to have a huge effect on how we trust an entity that we have not seen in person, basically, right? So anything where we can't absolutely validate that it is a human that I'm actually talking to.
And from your point of view today, where we stand, I mean, how do you define it in the present context?
So today, I think that you could say that, you know, some of the Twitter bots that are out there are synthetic identities. I think that I would look to see a little bit more sophistication. So, you know, LinkedIn accounts that are false but look absolutely real, like you can't tell the difference, but they are fake, or a Facebook account that is fake, or what we're seeing now, especially with some of the announcements with Google, you know, a conversation that if you cannot perceive that there's a human, not a human on the other side, like it's a bot that's talking to you, and you cannot make the distinction of whether that's a human or a bot. I think that's really the fit for where synthetic identity is. A lot of those Twitter bots, you can absolutely, it's a bot. You can see it, it's a bot. It's when it's very hard for your average person to make the distinction between is this a bot or is this a human? I don't know. I can't tell.
Yeah, and I think we've seen cases of this with things like romance scams, where people have, sort of vacuumed up someone else's online profile and somewhere like Facebook, and assumes their identity and uses it to scam unwitting people.
Absolutely. And I think you're going to see, so there's the age-old fraud that we've seen since the dawn of email, where somebody wants you to wire $10,000 suddenly because, you know, they're in a bad spot in the middle of Africa. The synthetic identity allows it to be a little more challenging to really understand whether that's real or not. And so I think with anything, especially when it comes to financial transactions, it's always, you know, making sure that you really know the other party before you do anything.
Yeah, I think of the example that we've seen in the past few months, where, you know, Google had a technology demonstration where they showed an artificial intelligence that was ordering up a haircut appointment for someone. And so I think, you know, certainly the possibility is there. You can look forward and see how that could be a useful application of this sort of thing. And yet I feel like folks, there's that uncanny valley problem. I think we just can't help having a sense that at a certain level, sometimes these things are just a little creepy.
Yeah, it's like a Black Mirror episode. You know, it's you're kind of in this new world that we weren't quite sure where if I picked up the phone and I had a conversation with somebody, I'm almost positive that's a human being. We're going to go into a world where that may not be the case anymore, especially if you extrapolate out. And so the question is, from sort of a policy perspective, you know, are we going to have policy where if a customer support calls up and it's a very well-written AI that you can have a conversation with, should it say, hi, I am actually not a real person, but I'm here to help you. And therefore, those folks who don't do that, you know, it's a little easier to compartmentalize and possibly make it so law enforcement can go after them. I don't know, you know, quite where that's going to go. Regulation isn't necessarily always the best way to approach something. But I think, you know, those organizations that put their best foot forward and think about that before anyone on the regulation side thinks about that, I think that would be a good thing.
That's Daniel Riedel from New Context. Returning to some other ESET research, the company says it found a banking trojan masquerading as a call recording app in Google's Play Store. The bad app was called Q Recorder. Google has given it the heave-ho. Duo Security reports finding an authentication weakness in Apple's device enrollment program that could be exploited for privilege escalation or rogue device deployment. Part of the problem is that a device serial number, and that's a predictable number according to Duo, well, it can be used to enroll a device. Duo recommends that enterprises protect themselves by requiring user authentication before mobile device management enrollment. They notified Apple of what they found, but Apple has yet to address the matter. It thus falls into that familiar, that's a known issue, category. Yesterday's hearings in the U.S. Senate covered online privacy. Big tech expressed general approval of privacy regulations. Some of the GDPR's requirements are onerous, but big tech likes consistency and predictability. So while in some ways regulation isn't really welcome, it does have some upsides for those who fall under it. Privacy laws and possible antitrust actions continue to loom over Silicon Valley. Finally, it's worth remembering our heroes, and one such received a last farewell Monday. Jean Briggs Waters, who died last week at the age of 92, was laid to rest at the Omaha National Cemetery. She was buried with a Union Jack over her casket and honors from Her Majesty's government. Miss Briggs was one of the last surviving Bletchley Park bomb operators who ran the code-breaking machines that yielded up German signals during the Second World War. She enlisted in the WRENS, the Women's Royal Naval Service, at the age of 18 out of an art school in Cambridge. During the war, she fell in love with an American Army Air Force pilot, John Waters. They married, and after the war, settled in Nebraska. Mr. Waters died in June at the age of 101, and this week, Jean was laid beside him. Thank you, Ms. Briggs, and may you rest in peace.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustai. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
And joining me once again is Mike Benjamin. He's the Senior Director of Threat Research at CenturyLink. Mike, welcome back. We've seen plenty of stories come by about Spectre, Meltdown, and most recently, Foreshadow. And there's been a lot of teeth-gnashing and hand-wringing over that. But you wanted to make the point today that maybe it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, I mean, any bug that hits our industry or puts anybody at risk it's of course interesting, and people need to understand it. They need to patch it or mitigate it, as the case may be. But if we look at the class of bugs, these are really very difficult to exploit when you compare to what we were looking at 10, 20 years ago, right? Gone are the days of a simple buffer overflow in a privileged application on an internet-facing service. The fact that we're getting into this complexity of chips really, really shows how much we've matured as an industry. So I actually think it's a good opportunity to step back, look at it, and be proud what we've been able to accomplish in terms of maturity to technology and software, and look at these bugs as not all a bad thing.
What do you say to the folks who make the case that this is a result of the chip makers not being able to increase clock speeds fast enough, that market pressure still means that they wanted to do things faster? So, they went back to the computer science books and they came up with these, they dug out these speculative processing routines, and without maybe giving it the closer look that it deserved.
Well, I think that's a little unfair. You can look at any technology advancement we've made in any area and probably point to some security issue that came out of it. Mm. And so this is part of evolving technology, right? And so academia has brought us some interesting methodologies in order to receive increased execution speed. And I don't think we should criticize necessarily everything they do. On the flip side, from a chip manufacturer perspective, this is a great opportunity to learn from the experience and think about how to properly vet these technologies in the future. So it's a maturity item, and the pendulum will swing both ways. We're going to have advancements. We're going to learn from them. And then hopefully we mature to the point where things like the class of bug that gets provided by speculative execution really is no longer going to be an issue after we learn from it in future spins of this technology.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, here in the real world, for folks who have to deal with this, should they be worried? What's an appropriate level of concern people should have with this?
Well, my recommendation to everyone that's asked me has been be aware of what it is. And so the concept of retrieving information through these bugs is a risk to certain organizations and certain environments. And of course, the environments that get mentioned most from the publicity that these bugs receive is always the shared multi-tenant cloud environments. Hmm. The infrastructure as a service provider environments is where other people's data is running on the same chip. It's being stored in the same system. And that's where the risk is. And so reaching out to the service providers that offer those technologies, ensuring that they've patch their environments or mitigated in an appropriate way so that you're not at risk is an appropriate reaction. From other cases, either the data being stored is not as at high of risk, or they're in their own private environments where they need to be aware more of other security issues in front of this and need to allow the natural patching cycle to occur inside their company.
Mike Benjamin, thanks for joining us.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire Daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Puru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.